This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 104, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com and Smart Pension. I'm delighted to be joined today by Michael Pearson of Claris Investments to discuss the latest version of his report into UK fintech financing, performance and valuation. Michael has had more than 25 years in FS and strategy consulting, including LEK, which has cropped up several times in fintech guests' backgrounds, so it must be a great grounding. Furthermore, he worked at TSB and Lloyds TSB in corporate strategy and development before creating Claris Investments in 2006, which conducts a wide range of advisory, research and strategy roles. And he is known for his excellent report, downloadable via his website, the FinTech Financing and Performance Report. We like broad people at LFP Towers, and Michael is certainly that. Picking another current hat, he is, for example, a non-executive director of Tanmaya, a successful Egyptian microfinance company. But on to the topic du jour. As you can't have failed to notice, a hell of a lot of so-called tech coverage in general is not about tech in the slightest. Rather, it's about dollars. This reflects many phenomena. First, the digital destruction of the media has meant that the amount of resource that can be put on any given article that you or I might read is negligible. Many media outlets, both mainstream media and indie, literally just reformat press releases as their staple diet. In the recent fiasco about reporting on alleged Syrian gas attacks, for example, the nearest UK reporter to the scene of the crime turned out to have written from over 800 miles away, and that's the nearest guy. Didn't stop any of these our man on the scene fake news reports, however. A further digital media age corollary is not just that the time per article is low, but so is the seniority. With few exceptions, the media just has to use cheap, inexperienced labour for most articles, inexperienced about tech and inexperienced about FS. So it's much easier to write about dollars and raises than actually the tech or the FS. And then there's the propaganda element. You know, the since noon yesterday, there have been $57 gazillion invested in fintech worldwide. To cut another long story short, that's just fake news about fake stats. And as I mentioned en passant on the show in the past, I know that for a fact, as one of the chief architects of a highly prestigious industry survey told me so. Another propaganda angle is that of VCs hyping up the so-called valuation in a kind of Ponzi scheme, the so-called valuation must always rise approach. That is, until you sell out to Megaco, list, or crash back down to earth. Finally, a societal angle on this phenomenon, and maybe Chomsky was the first to coin this phrase, is this awfully ugly but useful word, financialization. I noticed a trend back in the 80s that the word dollars just cropped up more and more often. It was very curious. The mad narrative of the world is revolving around the core function of currency and banking, rather than, in my favourite metaphor, in a well-balanced economy, banking and currency simply being the oil in the engine, and absolutely not the engine. So, to cut a long story short, despite over 100 episodes, I haven't covered this topic of financing. But notwithstanding all of the above, financing is the essential fuel for the fintech journey. It's a super important topic. I just had to find the right guest who I trusted to have conducted solid research. Michael's research, which I happened to read, leapt out at me as something that was solidly executed, which is to be expected given his background and that he too, like me, is an indie. Whether it's indie consultants, coffee shops or media, indie lives on integrity, which is far more sustainable than hype. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Michael, thanks for joining me today.
Hi Mike, I'm very pleased to be with you today.
Good, and so in terms of leading in, you were telling me a little bit about Egyptian football, which I'm curiously ignorant about. People might expect that I know quite a lot about Egyptian football, but I don't.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a non-executive director of an Egyptian microfinance company, so I've been going there for over 10 years. And my football team, Liverpool Football Club...
They used to be good in the past, didn't they?
When I was growing up, we were the best team in Europe. We've had our struggles, but we've signed an Egyptian player called Mo Salah, who has turned out to be a bit of a global superstar, probably the most popular man in Egypt. So now when I go to Egypt, if I say I'm a Liverpool Football Club supporter, everyone wants to be my friend, buy me drinks.
Oh, brilliant.
Talk about football. So it's a very good way of breaking the ice with Egyptians that you meet.
Yes, it's interesting, this international brands. I mean, when I did this gig for Landsbanki, Thoria, the head of risk over there, was a huge Liverpool fan, and he would fly down from Iceland to see Liverpool play football. So I've been well practiced for some time. As a former Aston Villa fan myself, I didn't have too much to boast about, but I did support them when we were doing well for a while, which was a very short period of time under Ron Saunders. But yes, I'm well practiced at teasing people about the fact that Liverpool used to be a great football club. Well, you know. Get the retaliation in first. I always like to, you said you listened to a few of these, as you know, so I always like to discomfort the guest and put them in their place before we kick off. So I mentioned briefly your career journey, which so it was obviously a very interesting career journey in that by complete coincidence, you went to a nice place in East Anglia for your degree at exactly the same years that I went there, actually, when it was always sunny in the summer, as I recall, and plenty of time for croquet. And you went to Egyptian microfinance and your financing report, which we're about to dive into in great detail. So how did all that work out? Was it just sort of one thing led to another?
Sure. Well, you mentioned university. I actually studied engineering, but came to the strategic decision in 1984 that a career in management consulting would be more lucrative, which is a sad tale of the UK economy, I think.
And then you went to another prestigious university afterwards to do yet another degree.
Yes, I was very fortunate to go to Harvard Business School with the support of my employers at LEK. And I learned a lot at LEK and at HBS. And then a change of career, I went into corporate strategy, corporate development in banking with one of my clients, TSB, which then became Lloyds TSB. My last job at Lloyds TSB, I thought, was the best job in the bank because I was running corporate venturing. And this is pre-crisis, and we were investing in startups, developing new ventures, doing innovative stuff at a time when, you know, not many banks were doing that. Of course, it's now all the rage, but that was a very good time. But it came to an end in 2006, and I left to become an independent consultant, which I've been doing since then.
And in the early noughties, what rough size of organisation in terms of number of people was Lloyds TSB-ish?
Oh, that's tough. I wouldn't remember exactly, but I would be guessing at about 75,000 people.
Yes, the actual number doesn't matter. It's more just the order of magnitude, because listening to you talking and thinking back to the different career journeys, Conrad Ford's been on the show a number of times, and he was doing strategy at Barclays as well. And
yes,
listening and reflecting on the fact that I think at Climate Benson we didn't have strategy.
Right.
We didn't really have a strategy. Things happened, we did things. But then you're talking about an organisation of, what, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000? I mean,
yeah.
We bought Greaves and Grant in the 80s, a stockbroker, and that was a strategy. But yes, apart from that, we kind of didn't need it. But I guess it's kind of a scale of empire. Once you're in the 50,000 plus or something like that, you absolutely need a department that sits there planning the campaigns.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so the venturing must relate to what you're doing now. So before we get into the report and your conclusions and all that kind of stuff, going back to my cynicism, sarcasm, /accuracy, delete as applicable, maybe you could give us a little bit of a background about your report, because it's definitely the case, and going back to the media, a hell of a lot what one sees in the sort of just the daily media is, oh, you know, new report shows that so-and-so, it's just some PR puff, really. So in all kind of research in this area, the motivations of why you're doing it is really important in the first place. And that's one of the troubles of the big ones, or the government produces something, oh, the UK is the best in fintech, and Ernst & Young says something like that. Well, their motivation is to make themselves look good. So maybe we can sort of start with your motivation and then go on to sort of the precise methodology so people can understand precisely what you have done, what the foundations of your research are, and therefore they can decide how much weight to give it and what the limitations of the methodology are and what the strengths are. So going back to the sort of motivations, did you wake up one night and thought, oh, I'll do a report on fintech financing?
Well, actually, it goes back a little bit to a few years ago when I was doing some research with EFMA, which is the European Banking Association based in Paris. And we were looking at fintech startups and doing some research for their members. But we were always frustrated about the fact that there was lots of information about companies starting up, but not much information about how they were doing, you know, whether they were going to be a threat to the banks or whatever. And eventually, last year, I got round to thinking about it and decided to look at some of the UK companies for my own research. And using Companies House data, which is a good source of data for the UK, but not necessarily helpful in other countries, just out of intellectual curiosity, I started looking at how some of these startup companies were being funded, how they were being valued, how they were performing, and just wanted to get some more facts beneath the sort of headlines that you talked about earlier about how well fintech was doing and how it was going to change the world. So it started with just a sample of five companies. I then added another five, got to 10. And I thought, well, if I'm going to write something about this, I should do a few more companies in the sample. So I got up to about 20, all based on the Companies House reports that in this country, companies have to file. And in the latest version of the report, moved it up to 39 fintechs, because what I tried to do was cover four or five from each of the main subsectors, because fintech is such an amorphous term. All kinds of stuff is going on within fintech. Mainly B2C, covering digital banks, neobanks, the alternative lenders, the wealth tech companies, insurtech companies, etc.
Yes, well, 39 is quite a large number, and there's a similar issue around the number here that I had with my research out of intellectual curiosity, which it started as well on the fintech boards, which I'm writing as this book, which never seems to end at the moment, just seems to grow. But from one sort of simple mathematical, statistical perspective, you might think that if you do 3,000 companies, it's going to be kind of significantly more accurate. However, it will be significantly more accurate about a different phenomenon.
Yes.
In that you won't, by definition, be talking about the best firms. And it's the same thing in my case. You know, I spoke to about 30, I think in the end, fintech CEOs, which certainly covers all the territory I need to cover. And I stopped there deliberately, because if I spoke to 100 CEOs or 200, then the average quality of the CEO or the average success they'd had would be getting that much lower.
Yeah.
And a bit like on the show, my focus is on finding rare individuals who are doing something special and then trying to report on that. So, you know, I can understand moving on from five companies because that's too small. But presumably for you at a certain point in time, let's say you're doing this in a year's time or 2 years' time or 3 years' time, you need to draw some line in the sand and say, look, there's no way I'm ever going to do more than 50. Or 100, or whatever the line of the sand is.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's not a full-time job writing this report, so therefore I have to limit it to some extent. I'd like to cover a few more of the B2B sectors, because I think there are clearly differences in the B2C business models from the B2B business models. And in fact, you know, many people think the B2B business models will be more successful eventually.
Okay, so just for simple-minded people like me, so you turn your computer on in the morning, get a cup of coffee, and go to sort of companieshouse.co.uk or whatever, and have they got an API, or just sort of write it down with pencil and paper, or do you sort of have to pay them a fortune for the data? How does it actually work?
Well, it's a good question. In my old LEK days, we used to have to go to Companies House and look at microfiche.
With a pencil and paper.
yes. But nowadays, and I can only actually make this work because Companies House now provides free access online to all these filings. So therefore, it's laborious, but it's relatively simple.
So they've got free online access, but they don't have an API. You can't write some clever program, just press some button and it updates your research for you entirely.
No, you'd have to have some way of scanning a PDF document to extract the data. And I believe there are people working on that, but you don't get 100% accuracy.
Not yet. Okay. So anyway, so the data is publicly available. Companies House data, like any data in the world, won't be 100% accurate, but it's pretty accurate, I would have assumed, correct me if I'm wrong, because various things happen if you submit wrong data to Companies House, like you end up in prison and that, so people are quite motivated
yes.
to try and produce the right data for it. It is a sort of, some sort of criminal offence to give them the wrong information, isn't it?
Absolutely, and of course there are caveats around accounting and reporting. You know, we know lots of examples of companies that have been reporting that they're doing very well for a number of years and then suddenly a catastrophe happens because they've not been sticking to the rules. So, you know, there are caveats around it, but I still think it gives us a pretty good indication of what's going on.
Yes, it is as solid a bedrock as you could possibly stick your foundations into, because it's what all equity investors use, it's what all research people use, and, you know, if you're about to even just invoicing another company, you check out them via this kind of data. So it's as strong as you can get, as opposed to these big airy-fairy $10 trillion went into fintech since last week, where fintech is undefined. Then the other parameter that sticks in my mind is that certainly when I file my company accounts, there doesn't seem to be a huge rush about it. So if you, for example, I don't know, let's take Zopa. If I go to Companies House today, log on, look up Zopa, their information will be out of date. What's the kind of time lag there?
Well, the financing information isn't, because they have to file returns within a very short period of time.
So it's the report and accounts that might be 12 months out of date?
It's 9 months for the report and accounts.
Right.
So there is a bit of a lag on the performance data.
Okay, so that's nice and clear. So it's an impressive report. It's not overly long for people who want to read it. I mean, it'd be less than a couple of dozen pages. You've got case studies in here of individual ones and a whole bunch of information. And so we don't want to sit here and just sort of read every line out, as it were. How do you think we best sort of dive into this and explain it to people who can't see all these pretty charts and that kind of stuff?
Well, I can talk about a few of the key sections, which are around financing, around performance, valuation, and then some of the benchmarks that I've created for the companies which are reporting for a longer period of time. Shall I just start with the financing?
Yeah.
So on financing, one of the first things I was interested to look at is how much companies were raising on their first round of financing and what sort of valuations they were achieving. And we found from the sample in the first round, the average amount raised was £688,000 for an average of 26% of the company. So that gives you an idea in your mind about what companies are going out to raise at their first round. And of course, with the report, you can see the variations around that.
And again, just drilling into that so we can understand how this works. So that number, 688,000, is the average raise of these 39 fintechs?
Yes.
So can you see within your data how that's progressed over time? So, for example, one fintech may have done its first round 10 years ago, another one 9 years ago, another one 8 years ago. Is there any sense that those stats have changed over time as opposed to the average of a group?
Yes, I mean, it gets to be more difficult in terms of statistical significance, but it appears that the companies that have been raising more recently in the last couple of years are able to raise more to get started at higher valuations. So they're giving away less of the equity compared to companies that raised in 2010, like a Market Invoice or a Funding Circle. I mean, Funding Circle started with a relatively small amount of angel investment, whereas I think fintechs that are starting today are able to go out and raise quite a lot more on their first round.
Yes, I think that I'm not that surprised at 688. I would have guessed it'd be slightly lower, just as a guess. But I was quite surprised at the 26%, how much people have to give away for their company. And as you say, just in terms of the trend of it, again, I'm not surprised that back in the day, 2010, 11, 12, fintech wasn't a thing, capital A, capital T. And therefore, I'm not surprised that it was harder to raise it. I mean, the firms that were around wouldn't have called themselves fintech. And equally, it's an interesting reflection. It's almost a measure of the fact that this fintech phenomenon, as it were, does actually help more fintechs start if people can raise more money for a smaller percentage of their equity now.
Yeah, sure. And there is a variance around this, as I mentioned. So, you know, we're seeing companies now coming in with, for example, Cover, which raised in 2015 its first round, raising 620,000, giving away only 11% of the company. So we're seeing some cases now giving away quite low percentages for first-round investors.
And just on that, and going back to my scepticism about valuations, which we'll come onto in a minute, the press reports these as valuations, but the actual reality of what's happening is that I give you X pounds for Y percent of your company. That's actually what happens.
Yeah.
Everything else is some kind of mathematical calculation. Yeah. So that's the actual data. Okay, so that was the seed round.
Yeah, and the sample companies on average have had 4.5 rounds of funding, so between 4 and 5 rounds of funding, and typically for an average 300 days between funding rounds.
That 300 days, okay, that does actually fit in with my experience, which is that, you know, depending on when I bump into people, there's just seem to be something of an annual rhythm to say, how's it going? Oh god, we're doing a fundraising again. It's like, you know, it's that kind of, their heart sinks and everybody's heart sinks once a year kind of thing.
I would say for most of the entrepreneurs, it's pretty continuous, actually.
Yes, because you don't raise it on one day of the year.
No. Moving on to performance, obviously, you know, you expect startup companies to make losses. And in the report, we can show the losses, the average losses in year 1, 2, and 3. The average loss in year 3 for the sample is 1.6 million. So that's not particularly surprising. What's perhaps more surprising or concerning is that only one company in the whole sample of 39 has actually broken even. So they're all still losing money, even the ones who are reporting in year 5, 6, and 7. The one company that's had a break-even year is TransferWise, which is an interesting case.
Yes, as we were discussing before, and I better not repeat it on the podcast, but I do know one or two fintechs that are making profits, and in one case, highly significant profits. And perhaps ironically, or not ironically as the case may be, the ones that are best known aren't.
I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, there are companies out there in the fintech universe which clearly are making money, and I'll try and identify some of those for the sample for the next version of the report. But yes, they tend to be less of the higher profile ones.
Yes, they're not in the sort of the broadsheet newspapers
No.
and all this kind of stuff, because they're sort of just getting on with the business and flying below the radar horizon, as opposed to the sort of more media tarts, as it were, whose sort of name is slapped everywhere. And we were talking about LEK before. Giles Andrews was at LEK, the chairman of Zopa. I remember when he was last on the show, he was talking about the fact that many fintechs still have negative marginal profitability, i.e. the more business they do, the more money they lose, which is not really ideal, because you can't actually grow yourself out of a hole that way. You just dig yourself into a deeper one. And in terms of trends over time about profitability, do you actually see any sort of J-curve effect here, i.e., you know, for 2010, 11, 12, 13, they're all losing more and more money on average, but actually that started to slow down, or it's starting to sort of look like one day quite a few of them, or even a quarter of them might make a profit? Or do you think it's still, despite all the kind of propaganda one hears about, oh yes, we're focusing on profit now, not just on market share, do you see no real evidence of that?
I think there's going to be a little bit of a change. I was going to talk about this later, but I think there'll be a little bit of a change in the next couple of years as investors start to put pressure on the management teams, the ones that have been more established for longer, to start getting closer to break even, at least, so that they can start thinking about exits of some kind. You know, and there are signs, you know, there are companies like Funding Circle has said that it will be breaking even in the UK, or is breaking even in the UK. Well, that's not come through in its figures yet. Revolut's claiming it's close to break even. Azimo had a fundraising announcement in the last couple of days, and they have said that they are expecting to be break even within 12 months. So there's, you know, there's signs that there's a few of them moving more towards that break even position, few of the more established ones, but I can't tell you that from the figures that I've seen from Companies House.
Yes, interesting. Again, just in terms of feel, that seems to be kind of my feel for what's going on. And I think the other thing that to drill into that, we would have to divide it up by fintech sector, as it were. So app-only banks are a relatively recent phenomenon,
yeah.
Whereas like TransferWise and Zopa, an exception, and RateSetter, they've been going, well, most of those have been going for almost a decade, and Zopa longer. And so going back to being a non-executive director, if you're a non-executive director, one of those, you could actually sit there at the board meeting and drum your fingers on the table saying, dudes, how many decades is it going to take?
Well, you will know the RateSetter people better than me, but I think that's an interesting case, because actually my figures show that for 5 years of its first 5 years of its life, it was actually managing a very tight ship, not trying to grow too fast, making very small losses, or even actually a very small profit in 2015, but then did a big fundraising in 2015. Clearly some investors came along and said, well, you could be like Funding Circle, or you could be like Zopa, here's a ton of money, go out and expand and get more customers. And of course, consequently, they've lost a lot of money in 2016 and 2017.
Well, I was sitting here smirking because I was thinking, well, there's two bankers talking here. And anybody that's been a banker for a few decades knows as sure as night follows day that you give lenders a ton of money and they go and lend it. And if you want to increase your volumes rapidly, your quality goes down.
That may be the right strategy for them in terms of building scale and making the investment. So I'm not criticising that, but it's very clear that they were managing the ship very differently until they got hold of a big fundraising round. And that may have been a phenomenon from 2015, when there was even more hype around the peer-to-peer lenders.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I always think of 2014, when I started the podcast, as the first year when one actually saw the word fintech in the broadsheet newspapers.
Yeah.
Before then, it didn't really exist. I was doing a gig for what would now be called a fintech in 2013 as their interim head of marketing, and they didn't call themselves a fintech, and none of them even used the word fintech in 2013.
Yeah.
And going back to RateSetter managing things carefully in the early tens or whatever they are, and Zopa certainly was doing that in the noughties. As you say, in those days, even what we now know as a great firm funding circle couldn't raise much money, and you had to be a little bit careful. You know, it's much more like being a sort of a grown-up sole trader with a few friends around. There wasn't just tons of money flowing in. So I absolutely see that, and I see the thing that sort of then scale comes along. But anyway, going back to the drilling upwards from that, I think my point was just simply in terms of where people are along the curve of, look, we've lost money for a while to get market share, and the non-execs drumming the finger saying, dudes, you've had almost a decade. You know, by that stage, it starts to get a bit embarrassing. You start to look at your shoes when people say, well, where's the money going to come? As opposed to the likes of, I don't know, a Monzo or something, which has only been going a couple of years. You don't really expect something that's going to make a big difference in the world and grow rapidly to be making profit in year two or something like that. And nevertheless, from your data, as you say, by and large, they're all basically still losing money, or some of the top 39 fintechs.
With the exception of TransferWise, which may have reached a tipping point in terms of its business model.
Yes, I mean, my problem with TransferWise is it's very hard to see through what was called the smoke and mirrors in a famous online article about them. Okay, so Michael, turning on to the valuation, and I should say for the sharp-eared listeners, there is a change in acoustic and we're surrounded by lots more friends at the moment. We did this valuation section originally in the same audio environment as everything else, but then on reflection we thought we could actually explain it a little bit more clearly, so we decided to sit here, even if it changes the acoustics for everybody. And for the listeners who think we end up explaining this completely muddily, you're really lucky that you didn't hear the first version. So let's go to the big picture. Let's start with how much your companies are raised, what their value are, and some stats around that.
Yeah, so the 39 companies in the sample have raised a total of 1.35 billion as of the end of March 2018, and they have a total valuation based on their last round of funding of 4.3 billion. All of the companies in the sample have actually increased their value per share since round one, and the average increase in value per share since their first funding round is 19 times, which is very significant, although the median is only 6 times. And that's because there are a number of outliers. So, for example, TransferWise has had a tremendous return on paper, up to 193 times since its first round of funding.
And Funding Circle's 127 times. And as you mentioned in your report, Revolut was another one that's gone through the roof, although that's not actually in the data yet.
Correct. If you look at the IRR, which takes into account that companies have been fundraising for different time periods, the median IRR is still a very healthy 92%.
So this is where we can simplify it a bit more this time around, as you say, looking at the IRR. As you were mentioning before, the industry tends to look in terms of multiples. You know, we put £1 in and we got £10 back, it was 10 times, and they don't worry too much about the sort of the time period. But of course, one has to bear in mind compound arithmetic. I mean, off the top of my head, if you double something for 10 years, you get 1,024 if you start with £1. If you triple it, you get sort of something like 60,000. Compound arithmetic is obviously a big deal in finance. But I think the simple takeaway for the listeners at this point is that of your data sample, some 39 fintechs, on average, across all of these things, their share price valuation, we'll come back to valuation, but their share price valuation, roughly speaking, doubles every year. And they're doing a fundraising in, as you said before, 300 days, but roughly speaking, less than 1 year. Okay, and then the other aspect to this was around valuation, and I was very keen to explain that listeners should not overinterpret the phrase valuation. For anybody who's done sort of economics at school or university or done MBAs and all that kind of stuff, you'll have this idea of valuation. It's an interesting idea, but should be only taken too far. It's completely wrong in one sense, in that the sense is that there are a number of people, and this has caused terrible catastrophes in finance in the past, who don't successfully differentiate between mathematics and the real world. Now, in doing this, I always think it's necessary to get a balance. You need the sort of mathematics, but also you need to know what's going on in the real world. And I think the simplest way of addressing this valuation thing is that what's actually going on in the real world when these companies do a fundraising is that someone gives them X pounds and ends up with Y percent of the company. They do that on the basis of getting their fag packet out and calculating stuff. But in reality, this is just a kind of finger in the wind, no matter how clever the maths is worth. Because as we know, let's say a VC has got 10 companies in their portfolio and they've valued them all and they've got the sort of, you know, PhDs in maths sitting in the background, they will have a value for each of them. But as we know, what actually happens in practice is that a large number of these companies are actually worth zero, some of them worth a bloody fortune, and some of them something in the middle. So to me, just bring it back to finance and all that kind of stuff, valuing these still very early companies is much more like an option. It's much more like how much money we're going to put on a lottery ticket, and we hope that some of these are worth a fortune.
I think that's very fair.
Now, you've got an MBA, so you'll come from the mathematical side.
No, and then the professional investors who are making these investments, certainly at the later stage of these companies, are all very experienced and have plenty of analysts to support their investment decisions. With venture investment, you know, there is an element of guesswork. Of course, what some of these guys are looking for, and you've spoken to some of them on your podcasts, is they're making some early stage investments around second round, third round, and then what they're looking for is the one that they think is really going to go big, and then they're putting big money behind those that they think are going to go big. And maybe Revolut is a good example recently.
Yes, exactly. And Revolut, as I've said many times, will either be the Amazon.com of fintech and do everything, or it will be the Chernobyl and be worth zero. So this is simply the point that these journalists talk about valuation, but I don't think any of them really understand it. The value of something being what you can sell it for tomorrow.
Yes.
This is not that kind of valuation. If you try and sell your house, you have a valuer comes around and he values it at X, and he's professional and he may have 30 years experience, but you end up selling it for Y. And you see the same even on the grown-up stock exchange where, you know, buy one share in BP, it's worth so-and-so, but if there's a bid for BP tomorrow, the share price will change. Now, the other interesting aspect here is, as you say, the various stages. Maybe you'd like to explain a little bit of the impact of angel investors in your sample at the beginning, and of course they value things differently. And then, of course, round one, two, three or four VCs, they have their own perspectives.
Sure. I think what we found is that of the 39 companies, 87% of those companies had angel investors in their first round of funding, which is great. It shows that the angel investment community is supporting the development of fintech. Having made a few angel investments myself as well, I know, you know, that at that stage of investment, you can do as much analysis as you like, but it's really, you know, it's really very difficult to be precise about what you think something is worth. So it may be that at that stage, people are going more on sort of general rules of thumb, or in fact, in terms of what demand is. Of course, there's the whole other side of this around the crowdfunding of some of these companies, which I won't go into here, is worth a separate analysis, because from what I've seen, at least superficially, that tends to produce slightly higher valuations.
Yes, and indeed, I mean, another way of looking at this sort of valuation is that you should have a plus or minus on it. So to say that TransferWise is worth $1 billion, for the sake of argument, it could end up in a couple of years being worth nothing or $3 or $4 billion.
Sure.
So it's a bit like quantum. You know, there's a distribution of potential places the particle might be in, and the breadth of the distribution, as you basically say, in a small company is extremely wide. And actually, it's a kind of a U-shaped valuation in that if you or I invest in a new fintech tomorrow, there's a high probability it'll be worth zero in 5 years' time because the vast majority of them blow up. There's not a lot of probability it'll be worth a small amount because either they succeed or they fail relatively rapidly. And then there's some probability where it ticks up again, that'll actually be worth quite a lot. So it's that strange kind of distribution. And just in terms of the various rounds of investors, again, from the conversations I had around my board report, if, for the sake of argument, you do a really silly thing, and I can think of one or two firms, but I don't want to pick on them, and you have a bunch of angels, and then in round one, for the sake of simplicity, you get one VC, and in round two, another VC, and round three, another VC, and round four, another VC, then what you end up with is a bunch of capital providers who are in at very different share prices. So, for example, your first VC is in at 2 and your last VC is in at 100. The bloke that's at 2 is relatively more relaxed about your share price going from 100 to 150. The bloke or lady that's in at 100 is going to be really pushing you much more, and the business and the board, to, you know, go global and all this kind of stuff, because they need to, for the sake of argument, to get from 100 to 1,000 to really make it worth their sort of kind of arithmetic.
You've also got complications with the terms that are attributed to each of the share classes.
Let's talk about the terms, because again, going back to the media coverage, they tend to say, you know, the value is $1 billion or whatever, and it was this price and they raised that much. And that's a quantity, but there's a qualitative aspect which is terribly important, and there's lots of sort of jiggery pokery and clever tricks and terms and all that kind of stuff. So I often think of it as the quality of a raise. So let's say your Claris investments, I'm going to buy into it. It's not just the price at which I buy into it, it's all these terms you put on me or I put on you.
Yes.
It makes a hell of a difference.
Actually, in many of the cases I've been looking at, the share classes are simply ordinary shares, which is quite interesting. So that keeps it very simple. But obviously, there are a number of cases where there are series. So Series A, Series B, Series C. And each series if you have the time to look into the documentation at Companies House, you could find out some of the terms that are attributed to each of those. One interesting case, which I've used as a benchmark later on, is Square from the US payments company. Because on their last round of financing, the investors were given a ratchet, which meant that on IPO, if the IPO valuation was below the financing valuation, the last financing valuation, the last round of investors were given more shares to guarantee them a return.
That is very naughty juju, isn't it?
It's not uncommon for those final round investors. And in fact, that's what happened. The IPO was at a lower value than the final round of private financing. But actually, since then, Square's share price has increased a lot, so they've all done very well anyway. But yeah, so you can find, you know, complications like that in the later rounds of financing in particular.
I'm not quite sure what we mean by benchmarks in this context, Michael. So benchmarks.
Well, it's this whole point about thinking about whether these performance and valuation statistics are good in the context of what others have achieved. And this is the first version of this analysis that I've done by using Square as a benchmark, because we have some performance history from Square in the United States.
You've confused me here. I'm being very dumb. I thought we were talking about Companies House beforehand.
Yes, so this is the one company in the benchmarks where I've taken, because there's publicly available data from Square, because it's been through an IPO, so you can see what its funding history was. And what I've tried to do here is compare Square with 9 of the companies from the sample, which have at least 5 years of reporting and are also reporting revenues, because some of the companies don't report revenues, they only report their profitability and balance sheet. So using Square as that sort of benchmark and looking at year 5, I've looked at what revenue growth is in year 5, what the profit after tax relative to revenue is in year 5, in other words, the profitability margin, what the revenue is in relation to cumulative losses up to year 5, because clearly, you know, you can pour in a lot of money and lose a lot of money and achieve only a certain level of revenue in year 5, and then look at the valuation in year 5 in relation to revenues. Comparing Square against these 9 companies from the UK sample, none of the 9 companies stacks up very well. So the metrics don't look good in terms of a benchmark, and Square might be perhaps a tough benchmark.
It's a bit like comparing yourself against Usain Bolt, or not quite, but do you know what
No, it's a very successful fintech and has achieved an IPO, but it just gives us a certain benchmark.
Yes.
And what I'll try and do is add a couple more benchmarks in for the next version of the report.
Yes, I think that's a very valuable analysis, and it comes back to why I liked your work. And as you say, it's ongoing. I think you mentioned you're going to do another version of this before the year's out. Touch wood, in that this is real financial analysis based on strong data, the kind of stuff, I'm glad to say I wasn't on the equity side, but the kind of stuff 30 years ago I would have sat there with a suit and tie on reading. And it is an amazing phenomenon of the modern world, for all its weaknesses, that any individual can have this kind of analysis report for free just by contacting somebody on the internet. I mean, it's, you know, 30 years ago you couldn't get this kind of information as an individual, and you certainly wouldn't have been able to get it for free. So just very quickly, we touched slightly on the future and all that kind of thing. You don't have a crystal ball necessarily, but you've been around a long time and you've really been looking at this data in detail. Are there any sort of major themes that you're expecting over the next year or so?
Well, I think the first one is that we've just started to see some exits, not from my sample, but some interesting cases. ClearScore, which is sold to Experian after only a few years of operation in the UK. And then a couple of payments companies, iZettle, which was going to do an IPO, but is selling
to PayPal.
And Adyen, which is another payments company from the Netherlands, which is going to do an IPO. Adyen, by the way, is quite profitable. ClearScore was not, and I don't think iZettle is profitable. So I think the earliest startup in my sample was 2010. Now we're getting into the range now where quite a few of the investors are going to want exits for some of these companies.
And the parameter we didn't mention, of course, is that when VCs do a fund, it has a lifetime.
Yes, although they can extend those and often do.
Yes, but there is some pressure on them to start giving the money back to investors, because investors start calling.
Yes.
Hang on, it's been 10 years since we gave the money. We haven't got a penny back.
Yes.
What are you doing?
And they need to demonstrate some exits in order to raise another fund, for example.
Quite.
So there are factors like that. So that's one thing. I mean, the other thing we touched on earlier isn't perhaps related to this. we're starting to see more companies talking about getting close to break even, perhaps just trying to send out the message that they're getting ready for IPO or for a trade sale of some kind under pressure from their investors. We could talk about one other thing and spend a long time on this, but I'm sure we don't have the time, which is initial coin offerings, ICOs. There was an interesting case which I looked at called BABB, which is building a digital bank, and raised quite a large amount through an ICO at the beginning of this year. I'm sure you've heard of them.
I try and stick my fingers in the air and sort of crawl under the sofa, because I get absolute tsunami via email and via LinkedIn of, oh, our blockchain firm is going to change the world. Our ICO is really great and not corrupt, honest, and all that kind of stuff. So I literally just go, la, 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 la. So I try and avoid hearing anything about it. But anyway, give us and the listeners a little sort of quick sketch of it.
The point is that my sample and analysis is based on companies that have gone through traditional angel investing at first round, early stage VCs, and now sort of later stage VCs with typical capital structures. But I think we're starting to see, and whether it's sustainable because of all the problems around it, I don't know, but we're starting to see other types of financing like ICO coming for fintech companies, which could be an interesting trend.
Absolutely, and maybe sometime I'll have one on the show, but at the moment I'm maintaining a position of sort of skepticism and slightly sort of holding my nose and clutching my pearls when it comes to these kind of things. Good, okay, well that's really very comprehensive, and it's just a taste of the report. And I just simply, I mean, just putting it simply, I just liked the fact that I read something that seemed to me truthful, accurate, interesting, relevant, and I learnt something. And, you know, that doesn't happen every day. It doesn't happen every month, frankly. Anyway, before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I'd like to thank my brand partners of the podcast. Actually, I should have checked through your sample, Michael, as to whether you're covering all my brand partners, because clearly you should, because clearly they are amongst the best fintechs in the world as they're sponsoring the podcast. Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages. 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out capital.com or download the app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So we've spoken a bit about your sort of background and you do this report at the moment. And just in terms of wrapping up the show, Michael, what breadcrumbs would you like to throw in the waters for people out there in terms of checking you out, contacting you, engaging you, paying you loads of money, etc.?
Well, first of all, please contact me if you would like a copy of the report, either via LinkedIn or through the Claris Investments website.
So that's Michael Pearson, P-A-R-S-O-N on LinkedIn, and Claris is C-L-A-R-U-S space investments, which I'm sure Google's heard of.
Yeah.
I'll include a link in the show notes.
Thank you. And, you know, if you want to discuss any of your research needs or consulting needs on this topic or in related areas around strategy and innovation, corporate venturing in financial services, please get in touch and I'd be very happy to have a chat.
Great. Well, thank you for that. It's been really interesting. And as I say, it's taken me over 100 episodes to find somebody that I was looking forward to talking to about this topic, about the reality of what's going on. And the reality of what's going on is fascinating. And I think it'd be to everybody's benefit to actually check out and find out a few of the facts that they're interested in. So thank you very much, though, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city. Mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.